Hamlet's tale aligns with the abbess's. The Hamlets had no gods, no ruler, and were overcome by sprites. The craftsmen came to the Tor in an attempt to unify, to decide who among them should lead. I had the gutting feeling whatever remained of my devotion to the omens was about to crumble. They fought, of course. Choosing a ruler is never an easy task. The brigand was cunning, the scribe clever, the oarsman strong, the forester intuitive, and the weaver compassionate. Each thought themselves more fit to lead. But just when hope of accord seemed lost, he paused for effect. Someone else came to the Tor. A sixth figure, along with a foundling child. They led the craftsmen to the top of the Tor, where a great limestone rested. From a fissure in that limestone, water leached, thick and slow, and smelling of sweet rot. One by one, the craftsmen drank from it. One by one, they were caught up in a strange, liminal dream. I waited for more. After, the sixth figure gifted them with these, made from the same limestone as the spring. He flipped through the pages of his grandfather's notebook, then turned it, showing me an illustration of five distinct objects. A coin, an inkwell, an oar, a chime, a loomstone. Each object carried magic great enough that the craftsmen no longer had to choose a leader among themselves. They all had power. Heartened, they retreated to their respective hamlets and used their new objects to obliterate sprites. But also, they whispered. Tales of magic, of dreams and portents, and the spring upon the Tor abounded. Benji opened his hands. And that was how the omens were created. I saw the pieces, like stained glass, come together. And the sixth figure, the one with the foundling who made the stone objects, that's the sixth omen, the one with no name. My throat tightened. The one we call the Moth. Indeed, though if anyone were to know her name, surely it would be you. He paused. She's your abbess, after all. The air in my body, the saliva on my tongue, went acidic. You saw what the harried scribe looked like, stone eyes. The king studied me a long while. No one at Ashling shows their eyes, and the magic stone objects, the sixth omen would need tools to carve them from limestone. His gaze lowered to my hands, my hammer and chisel. Those look quite old. Did your abbess give them to you? See what you make of them, or what they make of you. I didn't answer, which was answer enough. It's the spring, Six, the strange, magical spring, and the stone it bleeds from. That's how the omens came to be. No gods touched down into a dream. There were but six mortal craftsmen. I put up a hand. And the story the abbess tells? That's, what, fabrication? Not entirely. Benji found a new page of his grandfather's notebook and read aloud. Traum's histories are forged by those who benefit from them, and seldom those who live them. He looked up at me. The abbess tells of a foundling who dreamed in the spring, because that foundling was indeed placed in its waters. The child drowned, dreamed, and divination became a very lucrative endeavor. More diviners were brought to the Tor. In fact, diviners and the omens have always had a harmonious relationship. He leaned back in his chair and read another page. Faith in the omens is like a dream, shrewd yet shrouded. The signs from the five stone objects are plain, but the omens themselves are never seen. Smoke and mirrors and rumors, seemingly wielding these signs from everywhere at once. It is their scarcity that makes them sacred, their distance that keeps them divine, for only the privileged can access them through divination, thusly making the Master of Ashling the most potent of rulers, and the cathedral itself the most prosperous of markets. No one is above it, not kings, not nobles, not diviners, not even the omens. In conclusion, to rule the Tor is to rule Traum. Swords and armor are nothing to stone, I murmured, Ashling's creed chafing my tongue. I can see how your grandfather's sentiments might be seen as unorthodox. Indeed, they made my skin crawl. Precisely how did he come by this revised history? Quite by accident. As I said, he was a scholarly man. He became obsessed with the history of Ashling, which in time led him upon a personal pilgrimage to see if the omens did in fact walk among us. Let me guess, he found one. Not at first, Benji grinned. He found Rory. My brows rose. Mendacious! Good old Rory! Benji poured himself another drink and topped off mine, though I'd only managed a sip and a half. He was only a child, and my grandfather caught him thieving in the gutters of Castle Lurik. I'm sorry, what do you mean, gutters? Benji said it plainly. He's a foundling. It took me 5 seconds to speak. But he's a knight!
Who began as a lowly little thief, just the kind my grandfather liked to talk to.
The king drank, then coughed in an attempt to hold in a burp. He often said, it's the folk of the field, or kitchen, or the beggars on the street who know how to read the signs of life, not those heavy-pocketed knobs who go to Ashling for a divination. No offence. I glared from behind my shroud. My grandfather gave Rory 3 gold rings and asked him if he knew anything of the omens here in Traum. And what would you know? Rory's very master, who dwelled in Castle Lurik's locked chambers on the castle's highest floor, was an exceptionally singular man. He had fearsome stone eyes and stole all manner of coin and goods from Coulson Fair, but was never caught on account of the tool he used, one that could send him through walls or topple them. The artful brigand, I murmured, and his coin. Benji drank.
A bona fide omen.
What did Rory do for him?
A number of things. Using said coin on the artful brigand's behest, for one. Stealing spring water from Ashling Cathedral, for another.
My mouth fell open, and the king grinned.
He was a cruel master, I'm told. But the artful brigand's one redeeming quality was that he was a boast. He told Rory as plain as day that while Traum did indeed benefit from faith, it was the omens who truly reaped the rewards, that as long as they had Ashling's water to drink, they would live forever, doing whatever they liked, that the Abbess paid them to walk the shadows of their hamlets, cloaked and mysterious, like mercurial gods might.
I felt sick. The Abbess pays the omens. That was how my grandfather found them. First, he smuggled Rory away from Castle Lurik. Then he started his investigation. He tracked a shipment of gold from Ashling to a secluded spot in the Chiming Wood.
Can you guess who the recipient was?
This guessing game was infantilizing. The faithful forester, I snapped. He noted my tone, eyes wide like a nervous dog.
She was a grotesque figure, the faithful forester. Woman, but also twisted, inhuman. Her eyes were hewn of stone. My grandfather demanded answers from her, but she would not heed him until he defeated her at her own craft, which was a problem for him.
How so?
Listen, I'll be lucky if I end up half as clever as my grandfather was. But in one way, I am entirely like him. I'm useless in a fight, which is why it's important to have useful friends. And my grandfather did. A new knight from an old, noble family. A talented hunter, truly gifted with an axe. He grinned.
Maud. My brows rose. Maud killed the faithful forester.
My grandfather told her everything.
Benji drew his finger in a line over his throat, and off went the omen's head. Only they never found that magic chime,
To this day, it remains missing, hidden somewhere in the chiming wood. Benji's cup was empty now, his hesitance to speak without his friends cured by the ale. He poured himself another. After that, my grandfather was determined to unravel the conspiracy of Ashling Cathedral, to kill all the omens, starting with the artful brigand. Naturally, the nobles of the hamlets did not like that their king was profaning the omens. It implied that their beliefs, their creeds, their money had all been spent on a lie. And since the sons and daughters of the nobles composed the knighthood, my grandfather's own knights turned against him, called him a heretic, accused him of taking up the mantle. And suddenly, I remembered where I'd heard that phrase before. The abbess spoke it before every divination. The king swore to be more supplicant than sovereign, that he would never take up the mantle of his faith for personal gain, never seek the omens or their stone objects for his own power or vanity. The king let out a laboured breath. My grandfather was brought to Ashling, forced to endure a divination. 5 bad portents were divined. After, his blue eyes went cold, he was stoned in the courtyard by the knights and the gargoyles. I bit down, looked at the gargoyle snoring next to me. I'm sorry. He nodded. He was Maud's mentor, Rory's deliverer. His blue eyes flared. And my namesake. So you see, Six, our hatred for the omens is historical, professional, personal. I tapped my fingers on the table. Say your grandfather is right about everything, that the omens are mortal craftsmen who came to the Tor 2 centuries ago and now play-act as gods. I spoke slowly, granting the question the import it was due. How is it I dream of them in the spring? Benji thumbed through the notebook and found a page near the end. The scribblings faded with time. He pushed it in front of me. I know not how the diviners see the omens in their dreams. It is a very strange kind of transportive magic. Indeed, there is very little I understand about Ashling Cathedral's fetid spring. But the artful brigand, the beast, told young Roderick Mendacious one essential thing. There is eternal magic in the water upon the Tor, and those who drink it are just that. Eternal. It's the spring, Six. That awful, rotten water. The omens want it. He nodded, as if coaxing me along. That's why I came to Ashling a week ago. It wasn't for a divination. We needed to get close to the spring. Rory stole the water, like he used to for the artful brigand, and we used it to lure him out of Castle Lurik, then the harried scribe, here in the siege. The water, he paused, his voice quieted by wonder. It does something to the omens, their bodies, maybe even their minds. What has been done to us? I shoved the king's notebook back at him. I've been drinking that water since I was a girl. All diviners drink it. The king fumbled with his cup. Yes. What's going to happen to us? Red in the cheeks, Benji avoided my gaze. He looked like he wanted to throw himself into his ale. I can't be certain, but the artful brigand and the faithful forester and the harried scribe were, in some part, made out of stone. You're saying I'm going to turn into stone? He shook his head so forcefully, the table wobbled. I didn't say that. What does your grandfather's notebook say becomes of diviners after their service? Very little. Benji drank, pressing his hand over the notebook. His obsession was with the omens, I'm afraid. I was hoping... He looked up. I was hoping we could find out together, that you'd help me achieve what my grandfather never realized. He tried to smile. I want you to help me take up the mantle. I stared. That's asking me to betray everything I've ever believed in. Yes. Benji peered across the table at the snoring gargoyle, then me in turn. You believed a story, and that story was a lie. The omens are not divine. They are mortals who are paid like kings to live like gods. Imagine where all that money for divination might go if it wasn't spent filling Ashling's coffers or wasted in the hamlets on the omens. I thought of the impoverished, wandering the Sitch's streets at night. But doesn't some of Ashling's money go to foundling houses? It does. Gentle, his gaze. Have you considered that may not be such a fine thing? Foundlings are but another source of income for your abbess, to keep the facade going. I hadn't thought of that. Benji leaned forward. He was young and a little unsure of himself, but I was learning by the second that he was not stupid. He could sense that I was beginning to crumble. The faithful forester, the artful brigand, and now the harried scribe have been killed. Their wealth distributed in a way that will grant me favor when the time comes. I can change the hamlets with that money, and my own reputation as a caster as well. But if your abbess is indeed the sixth omen, I will need more than money, more than Rory and Maud, more than a magic coin and inkwell, before I return to Ashling to confront her. She has her gargoyles and hundreds of years of trust beneath her hand. If I am not very careful, I will meet the same untimely end as my grandfather. He smiled. But then, he never had a diviner at his side, did he? The king read a final passage from his grandfather's notebook. Faith requires a display. The greater the spectacle, the greater the illusion. He snapped the notebook shut, pinned me with his blue eyes. Come with me to the other hamlets, he said. Wear your shroud. It will lend you an air of prominence. Speak those pious words, ever but visitors. No one will suspect me of anything untoward if a diviner of Ashling travels with me. Folk of the hamlets might even look upon me with respect I don't often garner.
Because you are young.
His cheeks reddened. Because the name Castor is of a deposed king, and I was likely chosen by the knights, and by extension their noble families, to replace Augur when he grew too old, because they believed I would work hard to rewrite my grandfather's blasphemies.
But you're determined to do the opposite.
I want to replace false gods, to be a ruler unbeholden to Ashling. Maud is my right hand, a knight of noble birth, with great sway over the other knights and nobles of the hamlets. Rory is my disruptor, my heretic, my fearless sword. And you?
He looked less boyish, more cunning.
You could still be a harbinger, a holy signet of portents, of truth.
But for you instead of the omens. I sat very, very still.
So that you can kill them. What the omens are doing is not living. The king's eyes flickered to the pitcher of ale, but he did not pour himself another cup. I'm going to reclaim their objects and sever their power. In time, I hope to reclaim the kingdom's faith from the omens as well.
It was a compelling story, but it was hard to see myself in it.
I just want to find my friends. Then come with us. Wherever we seek the omens, we'll seek your diviners as well. The fervent peaks, the chiming wood, the cliffs of Belladine. In the meantime, Benji put his hands together, I can dispatch 10 knights today. They will venture forth with the sole intent to find your diviners. How does that sound?
I'd had mutton easier to chew on. And if we cannot find either, omens or diviners, have a little faith, Six.
As if he hadn't just annihilated it in the harried scribe's lair, and here again at this table, with ale and a prolix tale of false gods. But the king seemed without malice, young and a little drunk, but determined. Indeed, the nervousness he'd carried into the room was gone, as if, in proving the story of his grandfather to me, he'd proven something to himself. I stood from my chair.
You've given me a lot to think about. When would you need my answer by?
We leave for the Fervent Peaks tomorrow. I nodded, then stalled. If you manage to overtake Ashlyn Cathedral, what do you plan to do with it?
Shatter it. For the first time, the king spoke sharply. There will be no more diviners, no more dreams, no more signs.
I frowned, tapped the gargoyle's shoulder. He stirred, half awake, but accepted my hand without fuss. I led him to the door, stalling one final time. There is a part I still don't understand, King Castor. Benji, please. Benji. I paused. Why did the harried scribe lick my blood off his floor? A cloud passed over the glass ceiling, marring the light and the illusion of a gold crown upon Benji's head.
No one should live for hundreds of years, he said. The omens may be mortal, but they have no humanity left. They desire Ashling's spring water, and they'll have it.
His voice quieted.
By any means.
The room was wide, but its walls felt tight around me. Then, wherever they are, the diviners are in terrible danger. The king nodded.
I hope we find them, just as I hope you will help me defeat the omens.
He smiled, easy and boyish once more.
And I hope, in the vastness of the hamlets, you will stop thinking of signs and start looking to your own future, now that you are finally free of Ashling.
Benedict Castor was too courteous to despise, but I resented that he was younger than me and had so much more knowledge of the world, and that clearly I, in my shroud and stupid white dress, bore only the appearance of insight. I led the gargoyle out of the room. Maud waited on the other side of the door.
Well, how did it go?
I'm going to look for the diviners in the hamlets. My voice sounded far away. By taking up the mantle. The lines in her face tightened.
You don't seem very sure about that.
I handed her the gargoyle's stone claw. Will you find a quiet room for him and put a blanket over his head? He's liable to break something if he doesn't get at least 8 hours of sleep. What are you going to do? I picked my fingernail with the edge of the chisel. Wander. It was early afternoon when I returned to the yard, the knell of swordplay drawing me like Ashling's beckoning bells. The knights were still training. Two of them. The quadrant had been diminished. It was an open square now. Dirt rubbed into my freshly washed feet as I came into the yard, standing at the lip of the square, to watch the spectacle with everyone else. They were evenly fitted in body and weapon, the two sparring knights, each wielding a sword. I couldn't see their faces behind their helmets, but there was something distinct about the taller knight, the way he bent at the knees, like he was too lazy to stand to full height, and his shoulders, his back, long and broad. I was growing familiar, even in armour, with the lines of Rory's back. They parried, Rory's combatant the aggressor, his sword thrusting, answered and deflected every time. They churned through the yard, a chorus of clatter and force. And then Rory was upon him. He was ruthless, unearthly in speed, in vehemence, like he wanted, needed to unbridle himself. I felt the strikes of his sword in my flesh and the bones beneath, a shocking reverberation, like when my chisel broke through stone. Swords weren't the only thing they wielded. Their armor was his own kind of weapon. Rory's opponent struck him in the shoulder, the jaw, with his gauntlet. The next time he tried, Rory caught both his forearms, denying him leverage, only to be hit on the chin by his opponent's helmet. Rory stumbled, and my heart kicked. He shook his head, steadied himself. Then, with another lazy tilt of his long body, he sprang forward. His shoulder collided with his opponent's breastplate, and his arms wrapped around to catch the man behind his thighs. Their feet dragged through the yard, his opponent landing blow after blow along Rory's shoulders and back. I could see his legs trembling, hear the hot sound of his breaths, his torrid gasps as he held on to his opponent's legs. Rory kept pushing, kept pressing up, until he'd slammed the both of them down onto dirt. Cheers erupted around me. I barely heard them. I was transfixed. Swords abandoned, the two of them rolled, laying elbows, fists into one another, armor screeching its discontent. I hadn't seen knights fight before, never seen their armor, their weapons, as anything but ornaments. I hadn't realized so much of combat happened like this, on the ground, in the dirt. Rory came up on top, trapping his opponent with his abdomen, his legs, his crushing pelvis. Once more he leaned forward, putting his weight into his arm, laying it like an iron bar over the other man's neck. He was dealt more blows, soldiered more assaults to his back, shoulders, ribs, but he did not withdraw his arm. A moment later, the fallen knight tapped the ground 3 times. The yard roared with ovation. Rory's body went loose. He raised himself to his knees, then his feet, heaving and panting. He offered his hand to his fellow combatant, brought him to a stand, and the two jostled shoulders playfully. I heard the sound of laughter, and then Rory was removing his helmet, black hair catching the light, sticking to the sweat on his brow. He seemed at ease, like whatever disquiet warring within him had been spent in combat. And then he saw me. He went still, mouth half open. There was blood on his bottom lip, some near his left brow as well. The charcoal around his eyes was smeared, staining his sweat black. I'd never seen a knight so filthy, so physically degraded by his craft. He looked entirely ignoble. I couldn't look away. Diviner! I jumped. A knight stood to my left, his helmet under his arm. It took me a moment to tear my gaze off Rory and recognize him. Oh, Hamelin, isn't it? He gave half a smile. And you're... well, you're 6. Obviously, I don't know your real name. Tried to, though. He laughed. Sorry about that. I felt a little guilty for asking, especially after I'd, you know. He ran his hand down the back of his neck. Ruined the moment with talk. I shrugged. It doesn't matter now. My lack of insult or interest seemed to bolster him. He put on the charm, setting those perfectly straight teeth to good use with a blinding smile. I'd do it differently, you know. If you ever had it in mind to try me again, I'd... Hamelin. We both turned. Rory, slouched and lazy, arms crossed over his chest, was watching his fellow knight with so much blackness, his eyes looked like open graves. You and Rothspur are up next. I'm talking. Not anymore. Put your fucking helmet on. Hamelin's smile waned. He took a step back from me. Right. I should really... I didn't watch him go. My gaze was on Rory, on his bloodied lip. He kept his eyes on me too, then lifted his hand, curled a single, beckoning finger. I joined him in the heart of the yard. Quite the spectacle. He was still breathing hard from combat. You've spoken with Benji. Mm-hmm. He's answered your questions. As well as he's fit to. His eyes narrowed. And? And? My gaze fell to my bare feet. What would you have me say? I have nowhere to go but forward.
Then you've agreed to come with us.
I will. To find the diviners, I will. I watched his throat work, like he was swallowing what I'd said. Then he jerked his head.
Follow me.
Where? He was working the straps of his armor, pulling it off himself as he left the yard. I muttered a swear and hurried after him.
Mendacious!
The knighthood leaves tomorrow, he said. Traum is full of danger. There are all manner of sprites.
He looked behind us to make sure no one was listening.
not to mention the omens. You'll need better clothes, fortifications, better everything. It could have been blood, or maybe, just maybe, I caught the hint of a flush in his cheeks. I'm fitting you with armor. Chapter 14. Wax. The forge was fixed at the back of the compound, behind the barracks. Its hearth was lit, but not roaring. There was no steam, no oppressive heat, no blacksmith or armourer in sight. A tragedy. I wanted to see how they worked their hammers, shaping, reshaping. There was something enticing about hitting something again, and not breaking it. Rory dropped his breastplate on the floor, his gauntlets, and the rest of his upper body armour I did not know the name of, upon the floor. He wasn't wearing chainmail, just a pale, padded shirt. So, I tapped my foot. You're going to kill the omens?
Happily. Rory dragged a low footstool into the middle of the wide room. Your pedestal.
He retreated to the wall, losing himself at a long row of shelves, digging and fidgeting and flinging.
We start the armor today, then I'll send the order to the blacksmith at Petula Hall. We'll find chainmail you can wear in the meantime.
Where's Petula Hall?
The Chiming Wood. It's Maud's house.
And where is your house, Mendacious?
Don't have one.
There was more flinging, fidgeting. He pulled several glass jars from the cabinetry. They were filled with rough chunks of a cloudy, yellowish material.
Still fixed on Mendacious, I see.
I like the way it rolls off the tongue,
I'll bet.
The last thing he pulled from the cabinet was a cast iron pot the size of my head. He brought them to the hearth, an impressive juggling act, then upended the jars into the pot and set it over the grate.
What did Hamelin want?
To reminisce. Nothing breathtaking.
Glass clinked. Not a shining review.
I didn't bet him, you know. The lines of Rory's back went taut. What you said, the night we met, about me being sheltered and indistinct, bereft of fun, I bit the inside of my cheek. I took it to heart, so I arranged our excursion to Coulson Fair, with every intention of getting naked with Hamelin in the grass and doing something adventurous. To prove you wrong. Heat touched my cheeks. I wanted to show you that I wasn't too good for a night, just too good for you. His hands had stilled. When he spoke, his voice was low, tight.
What stopped you?
Turns out fucking someone just to spite you leaves a lot to be desired. Arms braced, Rory's hands splayed on the counter.
I wanted to get under your skin, he said quietly. I saw you on the wall that first day at Ashling. All in white, looking down your nose at me, so patronizing and pious. I wanted...
He peered over his shoulder at me.
I don't know. To sully you, maybe. To rip the shroud from your eyes so you'd know what I knew. That nothing is holy. That the omens were a lie. That you were no better than me.
He looked away.
But I regretted it. You should not have to bear, nor marshal my derision. I was cruel, and whatever you did to spite me after, well, I deserved to hate it, watching you disappear into the trees with Hamelin.
He gave me his eyes over his shoulder once more.
I'm sorry I was such an ass.
I didn't know what to say to that, so I said nothing. The forge remained quiet, but for the sounds of Rory at the hearth. Slowly, a sweet smell filled the place. Not saccharine or fetid, but... inviting. What are you heating?
Beeswax.
You're making me armor. Out of wax.
It's to measure you, you twit. I'm going to put it on your clothes.
I looked down at my billowing diviner dress. I hate to break it to you, but this is hardly the shape of my body.
I'm acutely aware of that, thank you.
He hunched over the pot, muttering aspersions into the wax as it melted.
First things first.
He dipped his thumb into the wax, came forward, planted himself in front of me. Even with me upon the footstool, he was taller.
I need to clean your mouth.
Because I said, fucking? He bit down on a smile, then nodded at my bottom lip, split by the harried scribe's blow, then again from the tussle in the alley.
It's for your wound, the cut on your lip.
Oh, sure. He waited. Must I spell it out? I permit you. Rory rolled his eyes, brought his wax-laden thumb to my mouth.
You don't like it when I'm a bad knight, he muttered, and you don't like it when I'm a good one.
I reached out. Smudged blood he'd shed, sparring from his own bottom lip, and wiped it on my dress. Have you considered that's because I don't like you at all? There it was again, the stain of a flush upon his olive cheeks.
Yeah, I've considered that.
It stung a bit, the stroke of his thumb over my bottom lip. Rory kept his gaze to my mouth, pressing wax over my swollen, broken skin.
What were they doing? He asked. The men you brawled with.
Stalking girls.
And that made you angry?
Shouldn't it?
Of course.
Each word held an edge.
I think children are particularly vulnerable in Traum.
I considered biting his thumb. You're talking about Aisling again, about diviners.
Merely noting that the Abbess always plucks foundlings.
His finger dropped from my bottom lip.
And always girls, to do her bidding.
Maybe foundlings are less likely to question that which is taught to them in kindness, I murmured. And the Abbess was kind to me. She took care of me, told me that I was special, that dreaming was divine. As to why she chooses girls, I learned it's about pain, how girls bear it best. Which rather contradicts what I just said about her being kind, doesn't it? A horrible fissure began in me, disrupting everything I'd believed in. She starved me for affection, for praise, then gave me just enough to whet my palate. I'd have done anything she asked of me. But if she's the sixth omen, the moth, she never cared for me, did she? I was but a piece of parchment to scrawl her false story upon, a cog in her machine. I bit the inside of my cheek, turned to the wall. I feel so stupid for my part in it. Rory's voice rooted in me like a fisherman's hook.
You're not stupid.
Brow knit, he examined my shroud. Not with irritation like he often did, but like he had finally been afforded a glimpse through it.
Her care came with conditions. You bent yourself to fit them. And now you see yourself as this terrible burden. Like you're nothing if you're not the best, the most useful version of yourself.
I did not like that, being so thoroughly charted. Thereabouts? He must have known that I wanted to peel my skin off and scrub it underwater, because he withdrew his scrutiny, retreated to the cabinets.
It's not true, you know, he said. You don't have to be good or useful for someone to care about you.
I watched his back, running my tongue over the wax-covered split in my bottom lip, the texture grainy, sweet from the beeswax, and salty where his thumb had been. When Rory faced me once more, he held a needle and a spool of grey thread.
I'm going to tailor that dress to your body, he said. Trim the excess fabric, spread wax on it. When it hardens, it should form a delicate exoskeleton with measurements accurate enough for Maud's blacksmith to make you a custom suit of armour.
His smile did not touch his eyes.
Your diviner dress will be ruined. Is that acceptable?
Try not to enjoy it too much. He rounded my body and gripped gossamer like it was the scruff of an animal, wadding excess fabric in his fist until it pulled closely against my throat, breasts, diaphragm. I drew in a stiff breath.
You all right?
Fine. Rory sewed me into my old, ratty dress. When he was done along my back, he moved to my left side.
Hold out your arm.
I did, and he gripped my forearm. Large as his hand was, it didn't fit around my bicep. He made the smallest hum of appreciation, then set to sewing my sleeve until it wore me like a second skin, then did the same for my right sleeve. You sew well.
Do I?
In and out went the needle, the thread whispering after it. Rory's brow knit in concentration, and I took the moment to study him. His dark lashes, his cheekbones, the ruined charcoal around his eyes. I've seen knights from the Chiming Wood wear charcoal like that. Maud does it too. I nodded at the three gold bands in his right ear. Those make you look like you're from Coulson Fair. He kept sewing, running the tip of his tongue over his bottom lip in concentration. I'm not from any one place. Where did you live the longest? Castle Lurik? His eyes shot to my face. Benji's loose-lipped. His grandfather's story required credence. You were it.
What joy is mine?
He sighed.
It's true. I lived for a time at Castle Lurik under the Artful Brigand. I also lived in Petula Hall with Maud, but the longest I was ever at one place was likely here, in the Siege. Pupil House 2, to be exact.
Because you're a foundling. I peered down at him. You might have said earlier.
Not my fault you were delusional enough to mistake me for nobility.
How then were you knighted? I thought
that one needs to be born within one of the Hamlet's noble families to be knighted. You'd be correct.
Rory stepped back to the cabinets and retrieved a large pair of shears.
There are, however, exceptions.
My sleeves, which had been tented, were now pulled tightly against my arms. Rory ran his hand down my left arm, down the new seam he'd sewn, and brought the shears to the excess fabric.
Keep still.
I dreaded it would feel like a mutilation, him destroying my diviner's dress. But the sound, shears, cutting through gossamer, was strangely satisfying. I shut my eyes and listened to it, imagining myself an insect, the first piece of its cocoon coming away. The room smelled aromatic now, the beeswax fully melted upon the hearth. When he was done trimming my dress, Rory snagged a loose cloth and maneuvered the pot of melted wax from the hearth onto the countertop.
"I'll need to work fast before it hardens," he said, pouring the wax into a pitcher.
He dipped his finger in to test it.
"It'll be warm at first."
"That's fine.
If it's too much,
it's fine." Rory's eyes, dark and derisive and guarded, had never been easy to read. They still weren't. But when he looked up, pinning me with a glare, I was suddenly certain those eyes were deeply unhappy with me.
"Have it your way."
He came forward, lifted the pitcher, poured a line of wax from my shoulder to my wrist. It didn't burn, but it was warm enough to hurt. I didn't say a thing. Rory's knuckles went white on the cusp of the pitcher.
"This isn't Aisling."
He took a full step back.
"Don't be such a fucking martyr."
I bit down. "Martyr. Pith mendacious. I said it's fine." He didn't move. "The wax will harden," I snapped. It didn't. After a few minutes of staring daggers, he approached once more. The next pass of wax down my arm wasn't so unbearably hot. Rory molded the wax over my sleeves until it was indeed a kind of exoskeleton, immobilizing my joints in place. He said the names of the pieces of armor as he worked, as if tethering himself to the task.
"Pauldron," he murmured,
his hands manipulating the wax over my shoulder.
"Rear brace."
He pressed over my bicep, then my forearm.
"Van brace."
He was entirely efficient. By the time the wax had hardened, there was not a piece of my arms he had not run his hands over. He did the same to the line of my shoulders, then my back, stopping at the distinct line of my waist. When he was finished, he rounded my body, gave me a pointed look, and dropped to his knees. I tightened everywhere.
"May I?"
Rory poked my thigh.
"The fronts of your legs."
I nodded. He painted my legs through my dress with broad strokes. When I dared look down, he was pushing fabric aside to get to my shins, and the fabric looked so sheer, and he, in contrast, so corporeal, like he was tangling with a ghost.
Hold still.
I am.
You're tapping your foot. Rory gripped my calf muscle. Now you're still.
He finished my left leg and turned to the right.
Greaves, he said, running the wax up my shin.
He cupped my knee.
Pullain.
I heard a tremor in his inhale. Fresh wax poured over my thigh, followed directly by the stroke of Rory's open palm.
Cuisses.
Will I be afforded a helmet?
If you like, though it may be difficult to see through both your visor and shroud, and only one will protect you from injury.
His meaning was plain. Take off the shroud. But he didn't say it. He seemed determined not to. Rory simply raised himself to his feet and eyed his work. The last bit of my body not encased in wax was my abdomen. My sternum, breasts, ribs, stomach. Every vital thing that resided behind a breastplate. The red returned to his cheeks.
You're nervous, I said, grinning. Why is that? Don't flatter yourself.
But you're blushing. Dying to fidget with that stolen coin in your pocket, maybe. Touching a diviner must make your heretical heart truly uneasy. Rory came toward me until our noses were flush, speaking within an inch of my mouth.
You know what I think, he murmured. I think you like that I'm a bad knight. It's why you feel so righteous, flaying me with your tongue, while you enjoy throwing me down and grinding your heel into my pride. It does something to you.
He wet his bottom lip.
I'd bet my oath your whole body is awake right now, aching and eager at the thought of putting me in my place.
I couldn't think. He was breathing against my mouth, and I against his, and the sound wasn't like any hunger I'd known. Torrid and depraved and desperate.
You want to throw me down? Rory said, eyelids dropping as he whispered into my parted lips. And I, prideful, disdainful, godless, want to drag you into the dirt with me.
He pulled back, his eyes as black as the harried scribe's inkwell.
I'll ask Maud to do the rest.
He rounded the stool, walked away. The door to the forge closed. I stood alone in a shell of wax, staring at the wall, willing my breathing to slow. The fervent peaks. Awe. Torrid and unforgiving, the river carves a path, always. Only the awe, only vigor, can divine. Chapter 15. Mountain Sprites. I rested my head against the wood lip of a cart, dappled sunlight dancing over my face. We were out of the Siege, past its cobbled streets and reaching bridges, back on the Holloway Road. I'd refused to look back, refused a horse as well. The gargoyle, heartened by the spirit of refusal, had declined to fly, and so accommodations were provided, the two of us riding like cargo, jostled about in a horse-drawn cart. I was wearing all the clothes Maud had left me, tunic and cloak and leggings. But the boots sat in a corner of the cart, untouched. Maud sat next to them, catechizing me on what lay ahead. The fervent peaks are rough, wet and wind-blown and cold. There's one road and it's steep. The village is scattered upon it, but most of the dwellings sit on a wide plateau where the Tenor River pools. Folk fish there, but rarely go higher into the mountains, which are almost impossible to climb.
What a horrible picture you paint, the gargoyle said, smiling and nodding, like he'd paid her a compliment.
When I dream of the ardent oarsman, I murmured to the sky. I fall onto rocks. There's a basin of water nearby, surrounded by seven jagged mountains. That's where I see the stone ore. Maud ran the edge of her axe over a whetstone. No matter the jostling of the cart, her movements remained controlled.
This basin of water, are there dwellings around it?
I don't think so.
What is around it?
Rocks. Her eyes lifted. Helpful. I threw my gaze out over the landscape, rolling moors covered in brome grass and craggy rocks, and tried not to sulk. I'm afraid I'm of little use. I have no idea where the Ardent Oarsman is. No idea where anyone is.
None of that. Maud's tone was firm. You being here is enough.
I'm surprised King Castor's grandfather didn't document the precise locations of the omens in his precious notebook.
Trust me, he tried. But the omens have been doing this for hundreds of years. They obscure themselves beneath hoods or use their stone objects to vanish at whim. They know how to hide in plain sight.
I say, Bartholomew!
The gargoyle was leaning over the lip of the cart.
Is a road still a road if no one rode upon it?
Road and road are two different words, Gargoyle.
Really?
A wayward branch swatted him over the face.
Perplexing.
Maud stared. You'll get used to him, I mumbled. She cleared her throat.
Right.
Why not find the Ardent Oarsman the same way you found the harried scribe? Leave a bit of pilfered spring water lying about. See who comes for it. Maud nodded at her axe.
That's exactly what we'll do. But first, the ceremony.
What ceremony?
The noble families host a ceremony when a new king comes. And since this is Benji's first time in the Hamlets as king, they'll be wanting to put on a bit of a show. Faith requires a display. The greater the spectacle, the greater the illusion.
So I've heard. I paused. Maybe we can use that to our advantage.
A brown horse came up next to the cart. Fig. Rory wasn't wearing his helmet, his black hair a mess.
He pushed it out of his eyes.
Anything of note?
I plastered a smile over my mouth. Benji and Maud will be at the ceremony, which leaves you and I to sneak off with the spring water and watch for the Ardent Oarsmen like good little soldiers. Maud's gaze lifted.
It's not a bad plan.
Rory's eyes flickered to my face. We hadn't spoken since he'd measured me for armor.
You want to throw me down, and I, prideful, disdainful, godless, want to drag you into the dirt with me. If you wanted to get me alone, Diviner, all you had to do is ask.
Maud gave him an exasperated look, but Rory just smiled, his stupid words winning two battles. Maud, irritated. Me? Flustered. And then he was spurring Fig, riding hastily up the line of the caravan to join Benji at the lead. I shot air out of my nose. Idiot.
He riles you.
Maud grinned at her axe, and you him. We've made an art of it. I sat up straighter, appraised her. How old are you, Maud?
41.
How did you grow so close with the brute and the boy king? She wasn't just older than Rory and Benji. She was more rooted. No derision, no drinking, less at war with herself. Maybe I've only been around women, but you seem better natured than the two of them combined.
Don't be mean.
Maud rubbed the flat of her thumb opposite the axe's grain. Benji's plenty good-natured. I chuckled.
Benji's grandfather and my mother were knights together. Our family's close.
Her gaze went soft.
I was already in armor when the little ship was born. His parents passed, and his grandfather was too occupied hunting down information about the omens to mind him, so we Bowers, that's my name by the way, Maud Bower, we took Benji in.
Maud looked up the line of knights.
It was hard for him, being a Castor, especially after his grandfather was killed. And Benji can be shy. It took him a while to get good with his sword. The other knights kicked him about. I put a stop to that.
So, you're like a mother to him?
She snorted. Don't know a thing about being maternal, but I suppose there's a pinch of tenderness under all this armor. I do love a stray.
Which brings us to Rory.
Rory.
I thought Maud entirely beautiful in that moment, her green, charcoal-rimmed eyes catching sunlight, the lines around her mouth, the crow's feet around her eyes, deepening as she spoke.
King Castor brought Rory, a scrawny boy of 11, to Petula Hall when I was the exact age he is now, 26.
She looked into my shroud, into my eyes, swearing me to secrecy with a simple gaze. He'd lost all faith in gods and men, needed a purpose, so I made him my squire. I couldn't imagine Rory as a boy, thin or small, or vulnerable. He was none of those things, almost as if he'd taken pains to carve them from himself. Why? I asked. Why help him, I mean.
Same reason you want to help your diviners, Maud said. Because you care, and because you're able to do something about it.
I pondered that. Was he a good squire?
The worst I'd ever seen.
I smiled. He was raw and impatient and untrusting, and the other knights worked him hard because he wasn't highborn and had no right being where he was. Let me guess, you put a stop to that and enjoyed doing it. But Rory settled in time, got stronger, smarter, meaner too. Or maybe he just stopped thinking mistreatment was something he deserved.
Sounds like neither of them would be where they are without you.
They'd have found their way. They're a good balance, those two. Benji wants to be resilient, like Rory, and Rory wants to feel like the kingdom is worth changing the way Benji does.
Or maybe they both want to be just like you.
Maud suddenly seemed battle-worn. The Bower women have a stalwart reputation, a legacy of hunters. The Chiming Wood was once full of fearsome sprites, you know. My family slaughtered them. When I was knighted, I had massive boots to fill. Then Benedict Castor I became my mentor. He directed my gaze to the kingdom's greater issues, the corruption of the omens, and Ashling's oppressive hand. She tapped her axe. I never understood what kind of knight I wanted to be until I struck down the faithful forester and discovered what a righteous kill was. Suddenly, I had a purpose, and it felt so good. But then Benedict took up the mantle, and the abbess called him a heretic, and the nobles in the hamlets echoed her. Maud shook her head. We take vows as knights, to the kingdom, but also to our sovereign. I would have done anything for Benedict Castor, and he knew that. Which is why... She hauled in a breath. Which is why he told me to deny him. That I could not go on, rooting out the omens and their stone objects, if anyone suspected I was complicit in his heresy. So when we knights brought him to stand before the abbess, and a diviner proffered him 5 bad signs from the omens, it was I who took him by the arm and dragged him into the courtyard. I, the first of his knights, to proclaim my withdrawal from his knighthood.
Her green eyes found my face.
I... Who threw the first stone?
The gargoyle and I were entirely stilled. That must have been horrible, I murmured.
Maud nodded stiffly. I made my own vow that day, that all Benedict Castor had learned, all he had taught me, would not go to waste. That I would bide my time, use my family name, my strength, to make another Castor the king. A king who would take up the mantle, and this time... succeed, that I would taste more righteous kills and paint my blade with omen blood. After all, daylight danced over the edge of her axe. That legacy of hunters shouldn't go to waste, should it? I slept in the cart and dreamed of Ashling, of my hammer, my chisel, working limestone, of bells that kept ringing, until I could not tell who was crying out, the cathedral or the stones I'd split. The cart jostled, and I woke. I looked around for 1, for 2, and 3, and 4, and 5, but they were not there. The light was dimmer than before, the Holloway road less deep, the trees more sparse, the landscape rocky and sprawling. I sat up, took in the view. The king's caravan was following the Tenna River, going upstream, headed toward... Oh. Looming far in the distance, Beneath heather-grey clouds that grew darker by the moment was a jagged mountain range. Stern and steep, its mountain tops clustered together like claws on a gargantuan seven-fingered hand. The fervent peaks. I reached out, and the gargoyle's stone palm was there.
"Could your friends be in that high, jagged place, Bartholomew?" he asked.
A terrible noise made me jump, a call, long and loud, starting as a resonant rumble and ending on the pitched notes of a shriek. It came from the north, and I looked out over the sprawling landscape, a nearby hill, grass and heather and rock, was moving. The noise sounded again, so loud I slapped my hands over my ears. The horses cried out, and the hill raised itself onto four hooved feet. No, it wasn't a hill. It was a creature with the appearance of a hill, its back decorated by stone and brome grass. It was only when it stood upon its legs that I realized it was like an enormous boar. It had granite tusks and wide orange eyes. Its mouth was full of dark mud, and that mouth was larger than the cart I rode in. Not a hill at all. It was Mountain Sprite! The knights began to shout. Maud was already out of the cart, volleying over its lip, barking, "Stay here," to the gargoyle and me, as she ran up the line. "Spread out," she shouted. "Ready your whips." The line of knights scattered, and the ground began to shake.
"I say, Bartholomew,"
the gargoyle blinked his stone eyes.
"What on earth are they doing?"
What indeed? Whips seemed an absurd weapon against such a behemoth foe. But then the knighthood regathered, a resolute line, riding at full canter toward the mountain sprite, cracking their whips. The sound was like a storm, sharp, volatile. "They're herding it away," I murmured. The sprite did not like the sound of the whips. It grew louder in its shrieks, holding its ground. I saw its wide, desperate eyes flash, and then the creature was lowering itself onto its great haunches and lunging. Four knights fell from their horses, knocked asunder as the sprite broke their line. Whips cracked, but the creature kept lunging, kept roaring, snapping its wide, muddy mouth. "It's trying to eat them," I said, hand to my throat.
"And look," the gargoyle said pleasantly, "it's coming our way."
It was. The sprite was not as quick as the knights, who rode in expert circles, avoiding its attempts to snap at them. But the gargoyle and I were still, and the sprite had caught us in its orange gaze. It came closer, making the entire world tremble. I reached for my hammer, felt a hollowness in my palms and the soles of my bare feet. "Perhaps we should..." The sprite's monstrous cry stole my words, so loud my ears screamed. The cart horse spooked, jolting forward, and the gargoyle and I were upended, tumbling from the cart onto the road. We fell in a tangle, my foot in his ear, his left wing lodging under my ribs.
"How undignified."
The gargoyle let out a whimper.
"Did anyone see me fall?"
"Bigger problems," I managed. The mountain sprite was closer now, its great eyes trained on our cart, creaking behind our cantering horse. It began to run after it, dropping its great snout onto the road, as if rooting. With five great strides, it caught up to the horse and cart, opened its gaping mouth, and ate the horse and the cart in one snapping bite. I heard the groan of wood, the crunch of bones, the horse's final scream. The gargoyle and I shared a horrified glance. The earth shook again, this time from the knights. They'd reformed the line and were riding once more toward the sprite, whips cracking. I took the gargoyle by the arm, yanking him onto his feet. We darted off the road, diving behind the cover of a craggy granite boulder. The knights cantered past us. I saw Maud in the centre, leading the charge. The sprite turned, its great eyes widening as it faced the charge. When it opened its mouth, shrieking loud enough to split the sky, I could feel its fury, its fear. The horses whickered, reared, but the knights kept their seats, save one who slipped from his saddle, unnoticed by the rest, who cantered ahead. He landed among rocks, his gold armor, gold hair, shining among grey granite. Benji. The gargoyle and I ran forward. When we reached the king where he'd fallen, the knights were a ways away. They'd come upon the mountain sprite, whips and swords drawn, and more horrible shrieks sounded. Are you all right, Benji? I looked him over, pulse in my ears. Your leg, are you... Fallen and caught between rocks like a pathetic turtle? The king gave me a queasy grin. Sadly, yes. The gargoyle tutted.
How embarrassing. I would never fall in such an ungainly way.
Help me get him out, I snapped, taking the king beneath his arm. The gargoyle took his other arm, and we tugged until Benji let out a cry. He shook his head. It's my greaves. The left one is stuck. It was. The armor around Benji's leg was bent from his fall, catching in deep crags in the rocks he'd fallen upon, lodging him there. We'll have to take it off, I said. Benji nodded at the horizon. They should be done soon. When I looked up, the mountain sprite was fleeing, the great beast limping and bleeding, crying out as it stumbled over hills and bluffs to get away from the knights. Mountain sprites are cumbersome and ravenous, but easy to drive off, Benji said. He looked to his whip, which had fallen 20 paces away. Sadly, I am as talented with one of those as I am on a warhorse. The earth rolled with such fervor, I felt it in my bones. The landscape was shifting again, another hill, another sprite, rising from the earth 20 paces in front of us. It came onto its four legs, stomping upon the earth, its great orange eyes wheeling over Benji. The mountain sprite let out a dissonant rumble, crushed Benji's whip beneath its hooves, and began to stalk forward. Fuck! I dove for the king once more, pulled his arm with all my might, but his armor remained trapped.
Do something, Bartholomew!
The gargoyle was wringing his hands, dancing nervously on his toes.
Bite off his leg if you must!
Oh, gods! My sweaty fingers slipped over steel. How do I get your armor off, Benji? The king's face had lost all its color. He was staring up at the mountain sprite with unblinking eyes. There's a clasp. I can't reach it. I ripped a fingernail, blood joining sweat as I wrenched at the clasps around Benji's leg. But they, too, had been damaged from his fall. I could not get him free. Meanwhile, the sprite, with its long snout and terrifying eyes and wide, muddy mouth, was getting closer. The knights had rallied once more, their attention and urgency directed our way. They rode full force toward their king. Oh, how they rode. But they would not get to the sprite before it got to Benji. The king shook, and so did the rocks around us, the mountain sprite drawing closer. Vast as its body was, its snout wide and its brome-covered skin thick, I could see the sprite was smaller than it could be. I could count its ribs, see the jagged points of its shoulder and hip bones. It was hungry, starving. Benji looked back at me, tugging his leg to no avail. Run, Six, he said, pale as death. Run. I dropped to a crouch, fixed directly between the king and the sprite. Whips cracked in the distance, but the creature kept coming toward us, its hot breath blowing the hair from my face. My hand fell to my belt. I withdrew my hammer and chisel.